listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Nikki Kalula. We're going to jump right into this episode. We have a very, very cool special guest tonight. We're actor Ash T. How are you? How are you, Ash?
Very good, very good. Happy to lower the bar tonight.
Hey, you know, you're not lowering the bar. You actually have a very interesting story because you are and or were a physician and you took the white jacket off for and the artist role of a lifetime and just being the actor that you wanted to be. Tell me, let's start with that, because that, I mean, you and I talked about that real briefly when we first met, and I find that incredibly fascinating because, you know, I was pre-med when I was in, you know, college, and it's like you did the Indian thing where it's like you go to medical school, you even went, you know, even more so and got everything done, practiced, and then you're like, I don't want to do this. So I respect that so much because it's not easy to do that with all of the, you know, like the social status of it, the tradition of it with Indian family members and friends. Everybody's probably like, what are you doing? But, you know, me being an artist and me making that choice a long time ago to drop the medicine and just pursue music, I respect it tremendously. So tell me what that was like for you. Let's start with that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, look, I wanted to be an actor since I was like 5 years old, right? I did a play called Ganbe the Duck Hunter, and I could never get it out of my system. I always liked to do plays, and I liked improv, and I would record it on my video. But my parents said, all right, well, that's great that you love acting, but maybe try to be a doctor first, and then you can become an actor.
Isn't that the Indian way? It's like, why don't you put your dreams to the side and pursue this thing that we think you should do first, sacrifice all this time to do it, and then do it later when you want to, if you want to.
I took it literally, so I did it. I went to medical school, and I got to say, like, when you are an artist, doing a field like pre-med and medicine is 1,000 times harder. I was like, why is this so hard for me to get into med school when my brother got in immediately, like got great MCAT? Like, why is everything so hard for me to get it?
Right.
I even had to apply, like, I think I applied 3 times to med school. That's how hard it was. But I eventually did get in. I didn't want to go to the Caribbean. I didn't want to go to India. It was definitely all ego. I was like, no, I got to go to an American med school because if I don't, I won't be enough.
It's so funny because you hit it on the head, because I have so many Indian friends that went to Poland for med school, or they went to Cuba for med school, or they went to some other part of Latin America or South America. And it's like, yeah, it's a different, it's just a different thing to go through the American, you know, colleges and go through the programs. Did you do like any BAMD program, or did you just like, you went to college and then you applied and then you were just like, where am I going to go pursue this other part of education?
I didn't get into a BAMD program.
But you really struggle with it.
Yeah. I mean, nobody knows this. They just see that, oh, he's a successful doctor. He has a master's of public health. They don't see like every struggle that I have, which is great. You know, like I can just show up. Here's the awards. I'm there. But like, yeah, definitely. I didn't get in. I had to get a master's of public health. I did 2 years of stem cell research. Then I finally got into University of Virginia and med school, which is very great med school to get into. And then from there, by the way, I failed a year of med school, actually.
Wow. Okay.
Only because I'm really lazy. And it was biochemistry class. I could not show up for attendance. They wanted me to get up at 8 a.m. and I was like, nah, I can't do this. Don't mind you that you'll have to get up 5 a.m. when you're a doctor, but I can't do it right now. Anyway, right. So I failed a year.
I can relate to that because I went to music school and all of our music theory and ear training classes were at 8 a.m. I had 8 a.m. classes all 4 years. It was like not fair. And like musicians, we never are up at 8 a.m. unless we're traveling to do a gig. It's like we're very rarely up at 8 in the morning to do a gig. You know what
we're
I mean?
We're drinking. You know, yeah. We're partying. We're living life in our 20s.
Yes.
How dare you make us wake up at 8 a.m.?
So you didn't listen to the signs when you're seeing all this. You're like, I'm just going to have to fight and trudge through this. That must have been so difficult. Were you at least telling your friends, like, I don't know if I want to do this? Or were you just like, I'm going to put my head down, just get everything done and just study and get this accomplished?
I remember this one time that the dean of the medical school said, I think you need to consider something else, PhD. And that really pissed me the fuck off. And I was like, I'll show this guy. Can I curse, by the way? I curse a lot.
Fuck yeah, you can curse.
You know, my mom was like, oh my God, I don't think he's going to make it. And like, I think all of those things made me realize, like, I have to achieve the things that people tell me I can't, you know, I don't care what it takes. So I was like, I'll figure it out. I'm going to get through this. I'm going to make it. And I did eventually. So
that's tough, especially when your heart is not in it, because it's one thing when your heart is in it, then it's like, okay, I can get through this. And you're going to still put up with adversity, but it's not the same as when your heart is not in it and you have put up with a tremendous amount of adversity and deadlines and the amazing amount of courses you have to take, tests. I mean, MCAT, that's no easy picnic. Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? It's like you did it. So how did you do it when you really just didn't want to do it?
I think it's from Star Trek. Revenge is a dish best served cold. And so if I have like this idea that someone tells me I can't do something, to me, I need to get revenge. And I'd be like, yes, I fucking can do it. Okay.
Right.
That's what fueled me to get through med school.
And once you were a practicing physician,
yeah,
were you like, this is not it. This can't be it. I can't spend all my time doing this.
It is interesting because I remember there was a time in my life where I was asking myself, what if I won the lottery, would I still be a doctor? And I think I had fooled myself into thinking, yeah, this is exactly what I would do. I would do research and all this stuff. Mind you, by the way, I was a good Indian boy and I actually got an arranged marriage as well. But two years as a practicing medicine, as a practicing doctor, I mean, I wasn't very happy with anything that my life. I was like, oh, I have all this success. I have all this money. I'm married. I have a house. But something feels off. I don't know what it is. And I talked to this fellow because I had to teach fellows at MD Anderson Cancer Center. And she was kind of like down. She's like, I don't know if I can get a job. And I said, well, you know what, Komal, you can do whatever you want to in life. But in that moment, it hit me. It was like, wait, I never did what I wanted to in life. I, through med school, residency, fellowship, everything. I would watch TV and I'd be like, I can fucking do that. Right. That's what I'm meant for. That's right. What I want to do. And so I took an acting class after that conversation with the fellow. And I said, okay, let me check out if I really love acting from back when I was 5 or 6 years old. And I did. It was really absolutely mind-blowingly incredible. It was like you find your childhood love. Right. I think that's what it might be equate to. I love the artistry of acting. I don't know that I have ever been connected to anything more in my life. As you know, from the short film that we were making, I really go very deep.
You were in it. And you know what? It's like I was so kind of like, you know, I was moved by your passion and your story when we first met, that you were like, hey, man, you want to be an extra in this? And I was like, yeah, sure. Let's do it. You know, it was cool to do something like that. Cause I haven't done acting since I did a lot of acting when I was in high school and college because I studied opera. So it's like we did theater. That's like the classic. You do musical theater, you do opera, you do acting classes. That's all part of it. And so like I was in all of that, you know, early on. And for me, what was funny was I would go out with friends and go to bars and I would see these bands that were terrible. And I was like, I can do this way better than this band or this artist, and this is bullshit. And it would kind of let
me. That's an Indian thing where both of us are like, I can do it better than these people.
Well, I mean, it could be like we're competitive, you know. We're also we're men, so we're naturally competitive with each other. But it was like, for me, it was like it woke something inside of me that I was like, this is not good, and I can leave an impression if I do this. And that's why, you know what I mean? It was like, that's what made me do the shift.
When were you first connected to music? What was that thing that was
like? I mean, I was singing in like church choirs at 5. Mm. I sang in a professional children's chorus by the time I was 7. And from like the years of 7 to I think I was 13 or 14, I sang at Carnegie Hall, sang at the Grammy Awards, and I was like a working musician. I was like making great money, and I was like, oh, this is not a real career, but this is an amazing thing to do on the side. And then I got into USC School of Music and pre-med. I had both majors at the same time. And when I went to, you know, visit my roommates, all of my roommates were music majors. And I was like, this is the wind talking. I'm dropping the music. I mean, I'm dropping the medicine thing, and I did in 6 months. But, you know, it's like one of those things, like the wind calls artists a little bit. You have to listen to the wind, and you have to listen to your heart. And it's like, you can't listen to whatever anybody else thinks you should do. And, you know, I think my family was a little bit struck when I said I was going to just do music. And then when I came home and said, I don't even want to do opera, I want to be in a rock band. That was crazy. But you know what? Now my family, they come to all of my gigs. They've seen me open for Dave Matthews Band. They've seen me headline House of Blues. They've seen a lot of really cool things. I brought them to the Grammys when I won a Grammy for writing a song for Ziggy Marley. So it's like, you know, those are the moments that I think are, when you say the revenge, it's not so much the revenge. It's like, yo, this is gratification for following your heart. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? It's like, but I understand what you mean when people say, oh yeah, you can't do that. And it's like, anybody's going to tell you when you really love something that, oh yeah, you shouldn't be doing that, you know, because they're just projecting their own fears or inhibitions or whatever. And I think artists take that on more than anybody. And I think Indians take that on more than any other culture, except for maybe Chinese cultures or Asian cultures, because I think they also go through the same thing of tradition, finding a stable career, you know, honoring the family, honoring the parents. So you know all of these things. And being, you know, the weird thing about being an artist or an actor or a musician, it's like, you know, these are the things that are not cherished in society unless you make it to this certain point. But at the same time, it's very cherished, because when you think of like when the whole world shut down, you know, during, you know, when people were getting the coronavirus or whatever, COVID, everybody turned to music, and everybody turned to films, and everybody turned to TV shows. And it's like, nobody turned to anything else. Like there was nothing else except for music, TV, film. And I was kind of like, this is what people need to understand, how important artists are, because it's not just entertainment. In times of like real dire straits, poor health, deathbeds, it's not, you know, how much money somebody makes or what career aspirations they had. It's a song, it's a poem, it's some passage that people are left with. And it's like, those are all artists that are creating those, you know, like we're dictating those moments for people. So I understand when you see something and you're moved by watching a show, you're like, I want to do that because that's how I should spend my time on earth. And that's the most immediate part of what I think you were feeling. You know, I'm projecting even saying that, but I'm going to ask you, that had to be some kind of ignition inside of you. You're like, I don't care what it is. I don't care how much, you know, bullshit I have to go through. I want to pursue this no matter what. Tell me that, what that moment, that crossroads was like for you.
Well, it was like that. Remember, I was saying that when I was in medicine, I was talking to that fellow and I had to take the acting class. That right. First acting class was the thing that made me realize, why have I not been doing this my whole life? I have to do this. There is nothing else that I can do now. Like, I'm fucked. I am, you know, I have to quit medicine. There's nothing else for me.
Yeah, I don't know if you have this moment too. It's like I had, so you know, when I was studying classical music, we always wore tuxedos, and we always, like, you know, that's what you perform in. You have costumes and tuxedos depending if you're doing operas or concerts. And I remember having this vision of, like, coming back from, you know, me as an older man coming back from a classical concert and then looking in my closet and pulling my old guitar out, and, you know, a guitar I hadn't played in forever. And I hated that image. I was like, I never want that to be the image. I want this to be the image where I'm, you know, I'm always playing guitars and I'm always writing and practicing. And, like, that's what, where my heart is. It's always going to be in creating and writing music. So when you made that transition, what was that moment for you where you're like, oh, I'm living my Dharma, I'm living my best life? What was that moment for you? Was it after acting class? Was it getting your first role in a major TV show? Was it working with somebody you idolized? What was that moment for you?
Yeah, I guess we can talk about this later. I think that it goes even deeper than outcome after a while. But yeah, I think the first time, it had only been 2 years, and I booked this independent film called Slayers, but it had, like, really big stars attached to it, Emmy winners and Oscar winners, like Abigail Breslin from Little Miss Sunshine, Malin Ackerman, you know, who's done comedy for years, Thomas James, Kara Hayward, who was in Moonrise Kingdom. I mean, so many people. And I was like, I have, like, a major supporting role across people that have 30 years of entertainment experience. This is amazing. Like, because you can go into this industry and suck at it, right? That would be a shame. That would be a shame. And even my acting coach, I think anybody can do art, right? And they can do it well. But there are some people that I know that would say, no, they can't. Not everybody can do it well. so that there is that fear. But anyway, yeah, Slayers was the first thing where I was like, okay, I did that. And then is that just a one-hit wonder? Am I done after this? And then I had booked Euphoria on HBO, and then I Dead to Me. And so I was like, all right, three times at least I've done it. So it's definitely worth it. Yeah.
Well, and it's also like that moment where it's like, you feel the rush. Like, I think that we, as artists, we live for these moments that are like, they're lightning in the veins. They're like lightning in the veins moments where it's like you feel the rush so, and it's so palpable that you're like, I could never do anything else but this, because this is what makes me feel alive. And I think a lot of people turn that light down within themselves just to get a job that makes ends meet and to make sure they can pay their bills, which is totally fine and normal. There's nothing inside of me that could allow that. It's like, I will find a way to make money doing what I love, because I'd rather do that than turn down that light. And that, I think that's what a lot of people don't realize, the amount of courage an artist has to take, especially the first year. Like, I know you feel like, okay, now there's momentum, it's like easier. But that first year, and I remember that first year of like, okay, I'm out of school, I graduated, I did all the things. Now it's up to me to make everything happen. And that first year was terrifying. Ooh. What was that first, you know, maybe 6 months, year for you, like when you were truly pursuing it and abandoning all security?
Yeah, you know, the thing is, when you go from living in a really big house to then like living with roommates, it's like, okay, I don't know how anybody's ever going to be attracted to me now, because I definitely don't have financial success anymore. And I don't have health insurance. Shit, I'm not really earning anything. Is this the right decision? But it's also fueled by excitement. So it counteracts that, a lot of the fears in the first couple of years. I think it's as you go further into the craft, then you're like, oh, crap, I'm still not making a lot of money enough to do that. But you found a way.
It took me, and it kind of changes. Like even if I have like great years of doing the thing, there's something that always pushes me forward to something else. Like, you know, I always thought, okay, once I'm touring, you know, multiple states, that's when I've made it. And then I did that and I was making great money and I was like, wow, this is really not exactly it. And then it was like, okay, teaching. Oh, there's something about giving back to my, you know, my tribe. Then it was like, okay, what about producing, kind of like being the producer I never had while I was learning to make records. And now I realize all of it, it's the wheel. It's like I pursued all these different avenues of the career path, and not one of them fulfilled me, but now all of them fulfill me. And it's like, now I'm in a place where it's like, I'm playing major festivals, I'm producing artists, I'm teaching, I'm performing, I'm like also having a home life and like having those moments. Because sometimes when you're an artist, you can just be touring or just doing the thing endlessly, and you have no sense of stability as far as your home life. You know what I mean? So it is a giant wheel that I've learned to kind of like, okay, this is how you have to maneuver, where you are able to do all the things that you want. Everything's fulfilled inside. Everything's fulfilled in your pocketbook, and you still have drive to accomplish more. And it's really the artistic achievements that still drive me more than anything else. It's like,
do you feel successful now, or is there something that you need to have before you can feel like you're truly successful?
I think there are always people I want to work with. That's a big one, because it's like what you said. It's like when you're making art with the people that inspire you, that's everything. I'm in the middle of making a record with Tony Levin right now, who recorded with John Lennon, Paul Simon, David Bowie, Peter Gabriel, and he's still, you know, working with Peter Gabriel heavily. And that to me was a huge goal. I worked with one of the Rolling Stones. That was a huge goal. So it's like when you're doing scenes with the people that, you know, Bob Odenkirk, Christina Applegate, like the people that you've been working with, those are moments where you're like, this is a pinch me moment. And you never have a limit of those in your career. It's always like, okay, now that I've done this, what else is behind door number 1, 2, and 3? What else can I achieve? So it's more like there's never a level of like, oh, I'm satisfied now. It's more of the pursuit. There's actually a sign, you can see it right here. It says, if you are on the right path, then you are always moving uphill. And it's like, that's it. And I have that in my room, always staring at me in the face, because you should not be like, ah, oh, I finally made it. That's not what an artist does. It's like, it always has to be like an uphill battle that you're digging in and trying to get better. And then as you're getting better, it's not a coincidence that these people that you dreamt of working with, you're now working with. So it could be you want to direct. It could be you want to write and direct. It could be you want to write, direct, and act. It could be that you want a certain level or an ensemble of people that you want to work with. It could be a distributor. It could be seeing, you know, yourself on a series that you've dreamt of. You know, it's like all those things, you know, that I'm sure that you aspire. Like, do you have those moments, you know, as an artist when you're achieving these TV shows? What's that next benchmark for you?
Well, right now, what I'm trying to do actually is kind of just be present and enjoy, not like have it feel uphill. So when I'm doing my scenes in class, I really get excited to go to class, and I enjoy the shit out of my enjoy rehearsal. I really enjoy that process. But I mean, I guess the goal has always been to have a career similar to Pedro Pascal does right now, you know, because you get to work on the best scripts. At my level, you do get to work on great scripts if you work on plays, the best scripts, but you don't get paid for it. But you do, like Last of Us, Game of Thrones. I mean, these are amazing shows to work on. That'd be a lot of fucking fun. I would love to work on Game of Thrones, you know?
Right. Have you seen The Bear? Have you watched The Bear?
I've watched a couple of episodes. I haven't quite finished it. Yeah.
So we just finished The Bear, and that show, I mean, there's a whole, this is what I love. I also love shows like this because there is not one name that is huge, that is top billing, and it's a whole bunch of unknowns, and yet the chemistry and the story and the writing and the drama and all of it is exceptional. It is just an exceptional series. There's an episode, I think it's season 2, called Forks. If you haven't gotten to season 2 and you haven't seen Forks, you need to watch that episode, because It is all about attention to detail and dignity for the craft, pride in the craft, no matter what it is. And it's like, that is one of the reasons I love that show. But I mean, I love shows that showcase, you know, I love the Game of Thrones. I love the, you know, what was the show you just mentioned? The zombie show.
Last of Us.
I just watched that as well. It's like, I love all those shows, but I also love when something comes out of left field and makes a huge amount of impact with Emmy winners, the Emmy actors, Emmy writers, production, all of it. And it's like, all the stars you love are watching this show. And it's not, there are no names in it. That is, to me, what really art is all about. Because anything can be marketed so well that it becomes a success. Mm-hmm. But when you have a bunch of no names and a show that no IP is attached to, and it does as well as something like The Bear, I'm blown away. Because it's like, this had nothing. It had nothing going for it. And yet everything about it made it work. You know what I mean? So I'm sure there are moments like that. You just did a short.
I have to say that exactly to me feels like the short film that we just made. People across the board, hyper talented people. I mean, I could tell you, like, the stunt coordinator was on John Wick. He was a stunt coordinator for John Wick. There was a DP from Ant-Man. I mean, like, everybody across the board was so talented, but nobody had any egos.
Right.
And, you know, Johnny was our director, and I've known him for 7 years. We were in an acting class, and he kind of has that ability to make everything very humble. It was a very humble set. Nobody complained. Nobody had egos. I was amazed by it. But yet everybody's so talented. And I really felt like this is the first film I've ever made where I just felt a lot of love from everybody, and everybody worked their ass off. And I don't know. This is exactly what I want to do. You know, like, make.
You had a great ensemble for sure. And one thing I was telling a friend of mine, what was really cool, it's like the amount of people that were paying attention to all of the details, from if the envelope was right side up to upside down to, oh, this apple was not in the right place, the flowers. I was like, that I was actually probably the most impressed with, was how many people were like in their lane paying attention to just these little mundane details that nobody would pay attention to. And that was their job and their role. And they had such pride for that thing to make sure that it was done well, so that every other part was able to fulfill and, you know, be accomplished and cross the finish line. You know what I mean? So,
like, talented artists.
Yes.
Art department, everybody across the board. The background. I mean, the background could have been main cast.
That's right.
No, I say that seriously, because I had a lot of people like, you know, Sarish and like all these other people. All of you guys could have been main cast if you wanted to. You know?
Well, it was cool to watch you do your thing too. Like, you were so in the moment. I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about that short before we show your other thing, your other short first. Do you want to kind of give a little backstory as to what inspired this short to come together?
Yeah, when I watched this Netflix show about Bikram Chowdhury, so he is the founder of Bikram Yoga. And then he was accused of sexual assault, and he had to go to trial for it. But then he fled the U.S.
Yeah, right.
And so I would always watch his interviews. I was like, that guy is so interesting to watch, actually. The shit he does,
yes.
He's crazy. That would be a great role to play. That's all I was thinking. And Johnny said, I was like, yo, we got to write something like this about this guy. And he's like, well, what if you played a bastard son of his that doesn't realize it's his father, but only finds out later on. I was like, oh, so you want to do a dark comedy? He's like, yeah.
That's awesome. That's so awesome. Well, it's so cool too. It's like, that guy has this dark history, and it's like, you're putting a little bit of a light on it, but also making it light, you know, like you're making it like almost accessible with using humor, but it's also, man, this guy is twisted and dark and does some weird narcissistic shit that, you know, needs to be exposed. But it's like, you're putting a spoof on it. So
yeah.
Did you finish the shoot?
All in the imagination, and really just explores the theme of what happens when you find out your hero, person you worship most, is actually a villain. What happens to that person? You know?
Yeah, there's a duality in the characters. That's what is awesome, too. So tell me, like, what went into kind of, like, your character arc, you know, for your story as you were kind of going through the emotions, because you were also having to kind of, like, channel some of that while it was being filmed, right? Because I was kind of watching how you were kind of tapping into that. Tell me, like, what you were going through to kind of develop that arc of the character.
Well, I train with this guy, Arthur Mendoza, at in Santa Monica. And this is a guy that basically teaches Benicio del Toro, or taught Benicio del Toro. If you watch all the interviews, Benicio del Toro, he'll say, "Who did you study with?" And he'll say, Stella Adler, but specifically Arthur Mendoza. And so I was like, "Who is that?" And so I found him online. I was like, "All right, I got to train with him now." So a lot of my work now is kind of ignited with purely imagination. So I have to come up with the concept of a mother and all of the memories that we've shared. I don't like to use my own personal depression or anything into it, because I think it wears out. But if you keep it fresh and you create a mother from scratch, you create the memories that really affect you, like maybe it's her giving you a puppy dog, and then you kill her off, then you can, you know, you can have that emotion come up. So just over time, I've experimented with different techniques. And for me, I think a purely imagination-based acting type is better for me than to use my own personal traumas.
Are you a method actor then? Is that right?
I think method acting is a Strasberg thing. But I do... I guess method really means, do you try to stay in character as much as possible? Yeah, I do.
Well, there's what is it? Udo Hagen has respect for acting. That's one school.
Yeah.
Method is kind of another school. Stella Adler's kind of like closer to the Udo Hagen, I think, but it's also its own
language. No, she's not close to Udo Hagen. She's purely imagination based, and she, you know, she taught Marlon Brando and Benicio del Toro and all these people. So it's definitely a little bit different. I think method is more Strasberg based.
Yeah, that's like like Jim Carrey, I think, when he played Andy Kaufman, was a method actor where he stayed in the character the entire time, even when we're off. And it's like, you know, that can wear on a crew real fast, I'm sure. But also it's like how you get into the character is 90% of it. You know, it's like
there's specific times where you have to just, that was a little bit difficult for me, because I did have like a lot of friends come through, and I guess they just have to understand that I'm not going to be Ash at a certain point.
Right. How did you find that separation where you were like, okay, cameras are off, now I can be myself? What is that decompression?
Oh, that's pretty easy to come back out of it, but it's hard to like stay in it when there's people that you know.
Right.
For sure.
Right.
And then especially, I go to TV sets, like Ironheart is on Disney and right now. And the lead actress would always start talking to me about my life right before the cut, and I'm like, I mean, she's really nice, she's a sweetheart, but I was just like, I'm focused on my lines, how are you able to just go directly into it and not have any problems like doing your lines? And she's just having a conversation. Oh, what'd you do? You did clinical pathology? Okay, action. I'm like, wait, hang on.
Like, let me get into that place. And she's
what was my first line?
That's funny. Well, I mean, it's like, it's funny too, also because you see how there's a psychology with it too. It's like how you get into the roles, or how people interact, or how they're using their own traumas to kind of like channel that into characters, or kind of like get into the mindset. Do you feel like there's a significant amount of world events or characters that you're seeing, people watching, that you're observing, that goes into how you kind of claim the narrative of a character? How does that influence?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, I go to a lot of museums, and I always try to take in as much art as possible. And the way that art moves me is very important in my craft as well. And you can just go to any of these big museums in LA and just see like what life was like in the paintings and the costumes. And I think taking in as much different types of music as possible as well. So that's one thing, taking in a bunch of art. And then people watching. I just watch. I'll go out to a coffee shop and just stare at people.
Right, right. Well, I mean, you have to, because it's like then you kind of get the little ticks or the, you know, peculiarities of people that you can say, oh, I can put this in my bag of tricks and pull this out when I need to. You know what I mean? I think that's important. It's like you need to do that. I read somewhere that Jamie Foxx, when he was playing Ray Charles, Ray Charles was downstairs and the director was like, hey man, I want you to kind of like access Ray Charles whenever you can. And, you know, for 3 days Ray Charles was sitting there and you know, the director came up to Ray Charles and said, hey, is Jamie come to see you yet? And he's like, no, not yet. You know, like we haven't had that moment yet. And the director, Taylor, I think his name is Taylor Pace. I can't remember his last name. But he went to Jamie Foxx. He was like, hey man, why aren't you tapping into Ray? And he's like, I want to do that more with the music, but he's like, right now I'm trying to get into the character, and I'm worried that if I ask him too many questions about the character of who he was, he's gonna give me the character from an old man's perspective. He's like, I'm trying to get into the young man that was Ray Charles. And the director was like, oh, that's amazing. And then they had this moment when it was music and he was just playing piano for Ray, and Ray was like, you know, Jamie would make a mistake, and he's like, no, why do you want to make a mistake? You like all the notes are right there. You know the right keys versus the wrong keys. And I was like, that's easy for a blind guy to say who just has, you know, using more of the frontal lobe to kind of access some of that. But it's also kind of brilliant and genius of Ray Charles to actually break it down that simply to like, oh yeah, just play the right notes, make the right choices. And you know, I think that's the hardest thing for us as artists to do. So do you find that you draw from people that portray characters? Who are those actors or actresses or films that you're drawing from that you think are kind of enhancing what you're doing in the profession?
You know, what's really nice is that YouTube has a lot of these real people. Like I was just auditioning for the Microsoft CEO, and I could just watch a bunch of his YouTube videos to try to pick up his accent and his mannerisms. So, I mean, you know, I can just study that for days and pick up some things from there. Daniel Day-Lewis always said that he starts with the voice. And so that's kind of where I've started as well. Every time I try to find somebody, I'm like, what's their voice sound like? Once I get that, then it becomes easier.
That's amazing. That's awesome. Well, I mean, he's gangster for that reason, because
he's so gangster.
Because it's like, that is one of the most convincing parts of a character. It's like makeup can do so much, but it's like that sound
is
gonna be the character. It's going to be the person. It's going to, and I think that's like why Jamie Foxx was so great as Ray Charles. That's why Daniel Day-Lewis has won so many Oscars, because he's just always into the character. Tom Hanks is the same way. It's like they just know how to get into character. I don't know if you heard the story where Tom Hanks was doing the Colonel for the Elvis movie, and Austin Butler is playing Elvis, and Austin Butler, you know, opened his mail one day, and Tom Hanks had sent him a typewriter. And so he and Tom Hanks were sending typewritten letters as their characters back and forth, just so that there was like, oh, this is how we're going to kind of connect and relate and get into character without even meeting. Then once we meet, there's a whole another role. So I just love like hearing stories about how people get into characters, because I think that's like probably the most important part of what you do as an actor, right? Do you feel like there's any kind of a text or moment or thing that you kind of use as your creed to get into characters?
It's a pretty long process, actually, if it's a major character. Obviously, for TV and film, you know, I'm doing like two or three lines. You don't need anything for that, right?
Well, I mean, you can. You can make them count. You know what I mean? So definitely,
but you don't need a whole lot of background in it, is what I'm saying. Right. And I think like for Slayers, for it's a more meaty role, you don't even see your scene partner until the day of the shoot.
Wow.
Wow. It's really tricky. And so, you know, luckily Malin Ackerman is a cool person. She's like, hey, you want to run lines? I'm like, do I? I'd love to, you know, but you don't always get that opportunity. But yeah, when you take on a player or a feature, you have to, you know, read through and you have to see what do other people say about your character? What do you say about your character? And what does the author say about your character? And you make a list like that. And then you try to figure out, there's so many things to do, you know, like right before you got to say, what type of animal does this remind me of? And then you go to the zoo, you study that animal. Like if it's a drug dealer, you know, you want to pick a skittish mouse or something like that. And that can help you figure, you know, it's really crazy. I did this exercise in class once where I was doing the mouse work. I was like, what is this stupid animal exercise shit? And then I get into it and I start doing this stuff and like Arthur's guiding me. And he's like, yeah, that's it. That's a drug dealer. I'm like, nah, bullshit. It's not. Then I go to New York like a month later and I'm actually watching a meth guy doing all the same shit I was doing in class. I was like, get the fuck out of here.
It's like, see, you're like hearing his voice. You're like, okay, this is why you have to observe. You have to observe. And it's like, also, I love like when you see animals and people, like you see the mannerisms are parallels and there's only a certain amount of emotions and it's how they all crisscross and how you kind of pick the combinations to make them work. That's what makes it really kind of sing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
So let's talk about your short that you're about to show a scene from. Tell me what the inspiration was behind this and tell me what went into the scene.
Oh, okay. This is actually a trailer for a different short that I filmed back in 2020 called Hip Baby. And while I was on the Slayer set, I was able to ask Abigail Breslin if she would direct. And she's like, sure, why not?
Wow, that's cool. Her
directorial debut is kind of cool. And so this is just a trailer for that whole thing. This is maybe the second or third film that I made. It's 30 minutes and we'd originally had it cut into 13 different episodes that were 2 minutes, but then for film festivals, we're just like, let's shove it all together and make a 30 minute pilot. So this is specifically as a trailer for the full version that's available on YouTube. If you just type in Hit Baby.
Well, let's check it out. Here's the trailer for Hit Baby.
One is a killing machine. The other, a total fucking idiot.
Sight.
A sight.
What's...
Oh, shit!
Run, dude, run!
I've studied all of your moves. Today, I saw it in person and... But... I want you to train me.
So, somehow training another killer will help me feel better.
Yeah, and that killer's me.
Пятая мерзкая тварь!
Ash and his little friend here are out.
Follow me.
Get out of here.
Yeah, let's go.
Not you.
Together, they must take down an international assassin ring or die trying. From the people who saw Bourne Identity.
I wanted to get rid of bad people who do bad things, like Dexter.
By killing people?
Coward.
And you're short.
That's low.
You're lower.
Hit baby.
Awesome. Awesome. So tell me what the inspiration was behind this.
Well, actually me and my friend, so that's Mike. He's the co-writer of that. And we met on a set and I think we were just frustrated with how the industry is. Like, we want to be seen. We want to be series regulars on a TV show. How do we get there? Let's make something. So we were just improvising a random scene about he said, hey, Ash, come over here. I want to film something, a scene about a guy that wants to be a hitman but doesn't know how to do anything. He's a computer hacker. And I was like, okay, cool. So we just improv the scene that day and they're like, all right, this is cool. I think we could do something with this. It's 2 minutes long. Let's write this whole thing up. So that's
amazing. Yeah. And tell me what the concept was behind the 2 minute philosophy. Was that just because people's attention spans are so little that you were like, let's just make little vignettes of this? Or was it just like, let's just power punch little 2 minute shorts so it's like in its own genre?
No, I actually think it's just all about budget. It's like, it's so much cheaper if it's just a two-man show and we can film it on our own. Like, in filmmaking, you just try to make everything as cheaply as possible.
Right.
So we were just, we just said, we can shoot this on our own for 2 minutes. Let's just do it and put it up on Instagram. This is 2020. I didn't know, like, TikTok was going to blow up. I actually think if we take Hit Baby now and we cut it up into 2 minutes and put it out, it might actually do pretty well, because this is...
You should try it. You should definitely try it. I feel like, you know, what I've learned with art, it's like, you are the tastemaker, so you make it whatever you think it should be. And then there's another side of it where it's like, let people decide what it should be. Like, make it short. Like, I feel like that's the advantage with reels. It's like, I've seen, like, how reels can just pop, because people's attention spans are so short. And then it's like, let me give you something long form too. So it's like, okay, I'll give you a reel so that, you know, that audience can get that. And then if you really want the long performance, I'm going to give you something that will satisfy that too. So it's like, I think you need both mediums in this kind of like current climate, because it's like, you can get a lot of bites on either side of it. You know what I mean?
And it's a really good point. And it's not only that, it's like tastes change so quickly. So I did this sitcom at USC, and the first time I posted it in 2021, it got 1,000 views. Then I took it again in 2025, 4 years later, and I added a hook like POV, I don't know what I wrote, something clever. And then I put it up and it got 255,000 views.
Wow.
So it's like, if you repackage your art in different ways, it just needs to get seen by the audience. Like, I feel like the art is good and we give up sometimes because they're like, it's not hitting. So the audiences don't like it. Let's move on and move something else. But sometimes maybe it is good art. You just didn't know how to package it correctly for an audience to see it. So that's kind of like where I am in the phase of, is it good art? Was it bad art? I don't know. Maybe I just have to keep repurposing it in different ways to get that answer. You know,
the funny thing too, it's like I had a reel that I just posted where it was a song called Revolutions. And the previous two reels, because I've been building up my YouTube numbers and we're at like 7,300 YouTube subscribers within the last year, which has been pretty cool.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's like, the two reels before it was like 1,200 views in like a matter of minutes. And then it was like 1,500 views in a matter of like 1 or 2 hours. Same with the other one. And then I released this Revolution song and it was very slow. And I was like, how could this be? This doesn't make any sense. And TikTok, I posted it and they were like, oh, we can't promote this because it's inciting violence. And I'm like, it's not. There are lyrics that are talking about revolutions. It's talking about the things that are happening, but it's not inciting violence by any means. Not compared to things that actually are inciting violence, where there's, you know, videos of people getting in brawls and stuff, and that's on YouTube, no problem, or TikTok, no problem. So there's a part of me that's like, there are people that are grooming certain things to be seen for shock value, for views. And then there's things where it's like, they are also slowing things down because it's control. It's like they either want you to advertise or they want, you know, they control the streams of how people can see your art. So it's like at that point, you know, it's that the lines of distribution are skewed a little bit. It's like you have commercial art, whereas like there's millions of dollars being put into every direction to make sure that you and I see X, Y, and Z film. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? And then it's like you have this indie market, which is like grassroots. It's like the Wild Wild West. And it's like if something starts to poke, you know, holes through society, then it starts to make waves real fast and they have no control over that.
Yeah.
What's really interesting with Anora, for example, which I, you know, I really love that movie only because it was just like, you don't see movies like that all the time.
Yeah,
me too. You know, and it was also like low budget, no stars, and then it won everything. And it's like, that was impressive to me because it was like such a fast-paced movie that just you couldn't look away. And there were no stars, and yet it won everything because the acting, the story was like nothing you'd ever seen.
Well, how do you feel about this? How do you feel about this? They spent $6 million to make it, but they spent
$18 million to market it.
Does that mean that any indie film with $18 million behind it could do that potentially?
I think that it was the perfect storm of it being good enough to be marketed? And I have a theory too. It's like, is art good because it's marketed, or is it marketed because it's good? It's like, really, those two things are the things I think about all the time. Like, Anora, would it have done the same thing with a third of the marketing budget? Maybe. But what if it had double the amount of budget? Would it have, you know, done even more in the box office? Because you look at something like Sinners, that movie, you know, it did 90 million, and the budget was like 30 million, something like that. It's already made $60 million or $80 million. So it was an unexpected success. And it's like, that was marketed, but not like the difference of what the budget versus the marketing budget of Anora was.
Right.
So it's like, you just don't know. And I think it just comes down to, A, it has to be good. B, it does have to be marketed. And I think what most artists struggle with, and I've gone through this myself, it's like, man, I've made something great, and then I have nothing to put in the marketing budget to really push it except myself pushing it. So it's like, whatever success it's getting is because it's, you know, getting marketed and pushed. You know what I mean? And it's like, that's just part of it. So, you know, the Grammy that I won was the first major thing that was marketed and pushed that I've ever created. And I'm like, man, if I had that same kind of budget with my own stuff, maybe I would be in a different place. But it's like, I also would rather just be making art than throwing money at advertising and marketing. But it's part of it. So I think it's an interesting conundrum that all artists kind of face. And I love that you're being very proactive with your career, with wanting to write, wanting to direct, wanting to act, wanting to collaborate, wanting to produce. You're just kind of doing, you're wearing all the hats. Do you find that, like, sometimes it gets overwhelming to do, or do you just feel driven by all of it?
Oh, I absolutely hate doing all of it. I just want to act. I don't want to do any other fucking thing. I don't like producing. I don't like writing. But my love of acting is so great. It is so powerful that I will do anything to continue to act more, which is means writing and producing. And
I love that. I love that because we share that, because I feel the same thing. There's so many there are promotional things I hate doing, but you have to do it if you want to be doing the thing. You know what I mean? So I love that you have that, and that attitude is everything. And that's probably what's going to propel you to the next thing, which is my next question. What is the next thing for you? Is it finishing this short, hitting film festivals? Is it writing something new? Are you kind of doing the whole wheel process, or like, you know, kind of like conveyor belt thing where you start one thing and then you're finishing one thing and already starting something else? How does it work for your creative process?
Yeah. Well, I'm always in class. So that's the one thing. I'm always auditioning for roles. So the only thing that changes then, right now, I'm very excited about this short film. I just think it is one of the coolest things we've ever made. It was the first film where people are like, I don't like it. The DP was like, you don't even have to pay me. Just like, I have to do this film because the writing is so good. And I've never encountered that in anything that I've made in my life. And that was, so I'm very excited about this. It's going to go through the film festival circuit after it's edited. And we're writing the feature in the meantime, in case, like, because the last time we were in the film festival was for a different thing called Miraclewood. I didn't act in it. I just helped produce it. And it did do pretty well in the film festival circuit. And we had meetings with Hulu executives. They're like, what else do you have? We didn't really have anything. So this time we're ready. We're like, all right, we got a good film. Let's make sure that we've written several things. So I'm just like trying to crank out a bunch of features while the film festival circuit happens within the next year.
Isn't it crazy, though, that the industry kind of works like that, too? It's like, you work so hard on creating something, you put your own money in it, and some industry schmuck, I'm just going to say it, it's like, okay, what else you got? It's like, that's like me sitting at the meeting and being like, cool, so you got to be CEO of Hulu. That's amazing. What else have you done? What other company are you running? Like, it's just, it's preposterous to me sometimes. And like, that's the mentality when it's like, I always want to throw it back, like, what have you made? What have you made to justify your position to ask me this question as an artist? Because
that reminds me of Glengarry Glenn Ross when Roma goes into Williamson. He's like, you're the middleman. I close deals. Like, you got this because of your family. Like, I actually booked my way to the top. and he's angry at the guy. He's like, what have you made? You've made nothing. I am. Anyway.
Oh, I love that. No, it's the truth. But it is the truth. It's like, yeah. And I always think of that truth source when it comes to art. It's like, I think artists, you know, we're kind of undermined a lot of times to have to do the dance and keep tap dancing and kind of like, okay, yeah, oh, I've got this party trick too. Oh, and don't forget this. And it's like the people that are in control, they don't have a lot of vision and they don't have a lot of talent and they don't have – the industry's built for people that don't have a lot of talent to make a lot of money. And it's like, you know, I've gone through this so much where it's music industry people and it's like I'll have a conversation with them and they'll try to like, you know, highbrow me with this and that. I'm like, well, I've done this and I've done that and I've played this major festival. I opened for this person. I've worked with this person. And they're like – by the end of the conversation, I had one guy at the end, you know, who worked at Universal. He's like, man – he's like, can I come work for you? I was like, that is a shift. But I mean, it's just weird how there is a narrative in the industry side of things that is so highbrow when it comes to artists. It's like, I don't believe in that. I think artists are tremendous. And I think all of those industry folks are easily replaceable. And it's what usually happens a lot of those things. Whereas if you see a great artist that has spent time learning the techniques, learning the craft to create and write and direct and produce something, that's not easy to learn how to do. That takes lifetimes to learn how to do one of those well. So it's just a lot of respect I have for an artist like yourself that is doing it, making the shifts, doing the dance, but like digging deep. Where can people find you if they want to find your art, have you audition for roles, cast you in something? Where can people find you?
Yep. BigAshT.com.
Spell it out so everybody knows.
BigAshT.com.
I always say spell it out because people are dumb. That's what I've been saying for years because it's the truth. You know what I mean? Yeah, you gotta spell it out for people to find you and let them know. And where can people find your short and the upcoming short on YouTube?
Oh, well, I don't think it's going to be out for another year, but it will be all on that webpage. Everything I do is on the webpage. So
awesome. Awesome. Well, Ash T, it was so tremendous to have you on Wake Up Hollywood. We're going to have you back on about 9 or 10 months when the next short is done, which you asked me to make a guest appearance. I'm looking forward to seeing that edit where I'm just in that little, you know, that little house scene. So
you're in the funeral.
No, it's going to be cool. It's thank you for asking me to do something like that. It was very fun to do. And I look forward to all the things you're doing creatively and all your artistic endeavors. And thanks again for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood.
Same. I look forward to seeing everything that you're making too. And I do see it.
That's what it's all about, man. Yeah, yes. You know I'm promoting like crazy.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, on behalf of Ash, myself, and Sam, we'll see you guys next week. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Peace, love, and hair grease.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.